Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Float like a butterfly, think like a bee.
There is one hell of a lot of difference in fighting in the rain and going to war in Vietnam.
Muhammad Ali was possibly the greatest prize fighter in history. When he opposed the Vietnam War, it was a shot heard round the world. Sports is war. War is hell. Sports is not hell. Politics, sports, and history. Oh, right. And the Yankees are going to miss the playoffs. It's The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning, folks. It's Tuesday, September 2nd. Good morning, John. And
good
what
morning,
a downer Adora. For Yankee fans, huh?
Yeah, well, it's not over yet, but maybe. Not looking good.
Today, Hurricane Gustav has been downgraded to a tropical storm. We'll take a look at the aftermath. The Republican convention is now likely to get right back on track. And, well, the convention is dealing with new revelations about their vice presidential nominee, Sarah Palin. Also, sports and race and politics, a new book, argues that sports are just all political. And turmoil in Thailand, those stories and more, but first these headlines.
Hurricane Gustav has weakened and is heading across North Texas at this hour. Watchers shouldn't just relax yet. There's Hurricane Hannah out in the Atlantic, lashing the Bahamas today. It could hit the Georgia and South Carolina coasts later this week. Gustav, at the end, killed 7 people in the United States. New Orleans residents are breathing a sigh of relief. 2 million people were evacuated, but they can't go home just yet. Mayor Ray Nagin says Gustav was no Katrina. Everything went according to plan, and residents may be able to head home by late tomorrow.
And of course, the storm did overshadow the beginning, at least, of the Republican National Convention in St. Paul yesterday. But it wasn't just the weather people were talking about there. Sarah Palin, John McCain's vice presidential pick, announced that her 17-year-old unwed daughter is 5 months pregnant. John McCain says he knew about the pregnancy, and Barack Obama says family matters are off limits.
I would strongly urge people to back off these kinds of stories. You know, my mother had me when she was 18.
Obama is at home in Chicago today with no public schedule. John McCain has stops in Philadelphia and Cleveland. Protests outside the convention in St. Paul turned ugly yesterday. St. Paul Police Chief John Harrington says his officers have arrested dozens of people.
The majority of the people that we've arrested at this point are for misdemeanors, that we do have a significant number for felonies, which are either assaults or aggravated criminal damage to property.
Anarchists apparently joined thousands of peaceful anti-war protesters. The anarchists attacked delegates, threw bottles, and slashed car tires.
One sad story, a humanitarian aid flight, according to the United Nations, carrying 17 people, has crashed in Congo. Apparently no survivors. Hurricane Gustav's lack of punch has oil prices dropping, and the stock market is poised to open higher this morning. Family matters are not off limits on this program.
This is Jody from Madison, New Jersey. Sarah Palin should stay home and teach her children abstinence. She's not a social conservative. She's a hypocrite.
We're talking about Sarah Palin and her family. We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Should Sarah Palin's pregnant daughter make news? Also, tough times for people in New Orleans, but are there some places, because of disaster threats, where people simply shouldn't live?
We've certainly gotten a lot of attention this morning on the Sarah Palin story. We want to hear your thoughts, 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
In the mix this morning, part of the conversation, of course, the revelation about Sarah Palin's 17-year-old daughter being pregnant. We want to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. We've gotten lots of responses. We're going to get to most of them this hour. Gustav, by the way, is now a tropical depression moving through the Midwest. And it's much easier to deal with a storm, we learned today, if most of the residents of a major city are gone from that city when crews begin to assess the damage. 1 in 10 people left New Orleans in advance of Hurricane Gustav, and it's probably in part because of something New Orleans Mayor Ray Nagin said before the storm hit.
This is the mother of all storms. This storm is so powerful and growing more powerful every day that I'm not sure we have seen anything like it.
Lolus Eric Eli decided to stay in New Orleans. He heard what Mayor Nagin had to say. Lolus is a Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune. We spoke to him yesterday before the scale of Gustav was known, but he wrote a column about the mother of all storms statement of Mayor Ray Nagin. Lolus, thanks for joining us again.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
First of all, how are you doing?
Doing well, except there's still no power in my neighborhood.
So what is your reaction to Ray Nagin's strategy for getting the people out of New Orleans and sort of take the pulse of the people who remained as to, you know, what people think of this policy? It seems on one level that it's much simpler to deal with any kind of a storm if most of the people are out of the way. That eliminates most of the traffic, most of the rescue issues. What do you think?
Well, the mayor had a difficult decision to make. Because had he not been sufficiently vigilant in this, then the level of criticism would have been incredible. And by the same token, the president and vice president did something similar. They didn't make a statement like that, but they made it clear that their number one priority yesterday was dealing with Hurricane Gustav. The problem, of course, is trying to convey to the entire population of a city that the precision of hurricane predictions gets better and better as you get closer, and therefore, even if I tell you 36 hours in advance that the storm is going to be massive, it is possible that 12 hours in advance that information may change. And in fact, in this case, it did. By late Sunday morning, early Sunday afternoon, it had become clear that it was not going to be as massive a storm as the one the mayor was describing as having come off the coast of Cuba.
So, Lolas, how much of the evacuation do you credit to Nagin's statement and the statements of other public officials, and how much of it is just due to the fear of having been through Katrina 3 years ago?
I might say 50-50. There's a fair amount of people who take the position that they're evacuating any time it's a Category 3 or above from now on. But I'm thinking of one friend of mine in particular who evacuated for Hurricane Katrina, stayed during Rita, and was planning to stay up until Sunday afternoon when she decided she just had to go. She was too scared of the possibility, based largely on the mayor's statement.
But, Lolas, as you said, it really is between a rock and a hard place because hurricanes are very difficult, even up to the very last hours before it hits, to predict exactly what it's going to look like when it hits land. So in that situation, what do you do when you know you have all of these potential people at risk?
Well, I think certainly high-risk people need to be moved as soon as possible. And part of it really gets to be a sort of cry-wolf situation. In that I was talking to one of my neighbors who basically was saying that the prediction procedures, the prediction technology wasn't any good, so he was staying because he didn't believe them. And that's a ridiculous statement. The truth is that the prediction is getting better and better, but trying to explain to people that, well, if you really want to be sure, you need to be out of here 36 or 48 hours in advance. But if you want to wait until 24 hours, the prediction will be better, and perhaps by then you won't have to leave. That's a very subtle thing to try to explain to roughly a million people in the metro area.
Well, you know, it is interesting because it does seem that the media has a dual mission here. On the one hand, they want to be accurate with the information, but on the other hand, you can almost sense there's a sort of coveting of a big giant story here that encourages people to exaggerate.
Right, and in fact, you can imagine. Particularly the cable news channels, who have to fill a 24-hour news hole and to keep people on the tube trying to figure out what's happening with Gustav would certainly be to their advantage in terms of maintaining audience.
Acquiring a flood of TV audience members versus resisting a flood in New Orleans, that's sort of the trade-off, I guess, in the media. Lolas, I hope the power comes on soon.
Okay. Well, thanks, and y'all take care.
Lolas Eric Eli is a Metro columnist for the Times-Picayune who stayed in New Orleans all during Gustav and is there now.
Yeah, tough dilemma, but the Republican National Convention in St. Paul, Minnesota, they should get back to normal after the interruption of Hurricane Gustav. Rudy Giuliani is likely to give the keynote address tonight, and the White House says it's still possible President Bush will address convention delegates, perhaps by a video link. Much of the attention, though, will turn to Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, who is John McCain's running mate or his nominee for his vice presidential nominee pick. And with new details about her administration and her family emerging, some questions have been triggered about how she was vetted exactly. We're going to get to more about that later. But first, reaction in Alaska to her nomination and news that her 17-year-old daughter is pregnant. We turn to Libby Casey, who is a political reporter for the Alaska Public Radio Network, who got up very early for us. Thank you, Libby.
Good morning. My pleasure.
So what was the reaction or what has been the reaction in Alaska to news that the governor's 17-year-old daughter is pregnant?
Of course, surprise. But Alaskans are still reeling from the surprise on Friday that our governor has been selected to run for vice president. I think a lot of people are still waking up in the morning and saying, did that really happen? And had Palin not been tapped to be put on the Republican ticket, the news of Bristol's pregnancy, Bristol's 17 years old, would have been a surprise here and would have been something people would talk about, you know, around the water cooler or out at hunting camp. But I think that news would have died down soon enough. And the next questions people ask are, well, how is that going to affect her life and how will that affect the governor's life? But of course, this has been launched onto the national spotlight now. So reporters are descending all over Anchorage, which is close to the governor's hometown. And I think Alaskans are just trying to step back and sort of soak all this in and realize we're not in like small town world anymore. We, as well as the governor, have been launched onto the national stage.
She has been described as a very popular governor there in Alaska. Do you think that's accurate?
Absolutely. You know, she has had approval ratings at over 80%. And Governor Palin is still really early on in her governorship, though. I mean, she's been a governor for less than 2 years, for about 20 months. And she ran at a time that Alaskans were very frustrated with charges of corruption. We've had numerous state legislators indicted, convicted for corruption. And our former governor, Frank Murkowski, had very low approval ratings. He wasn't really listening to what people were asking for. Palin came in and said, I'm going to listen. I'm going to shake things up. I'm going to run on a reform agenda. And she's followed through on those things. And let's not forget, you know, Alaskans are having to deal with very high fuel prices right now. Of course, fuel is expensive everywhere. But here in Alaska, it's especially high. In some places in rural Alaska, a gallon of gas is $10. And we're getting ready to head into winter now, which means, you know, you got to fill up the fuel tanks to heat your home.
Libby,
and the governor.
Let me ask you just one quick question, because we have about a minute and a half, about the daughter, Bristol. Is it more controversial in Alaska for a 17-year-old who's pregnant to keep the baby or to end the pregnancy because they're a teen and maybe it's too early for them to raise a child?
Oh, absolutely. The idea of aborting the child would be extremely controversial right here, especially given the fact that Governor Palin is so strongly pro-life. I mean, she believes in keeping a baby even in a case of rape or incest. And so I think Alaskans would be, especially conservative Alaskans, would be concerned about the idea of a teenager aborting the child. Alaskans are also very independent and like people to have their privacy. So, you know, the delegates who are representing Alaska at the Republican convention love Sarah Palin. This is shaking things up for them, and I think they would be devastated if the family had chosen to abort the child.
Libby Casey, many thanks.
Thanks a lot.
Libby Casey is a political reporter for Alaska Public Radio Network.
Should candidates be judged on the behavior of their children? Here's a response from one of you.
This is Farm Boy from Minnesota. Suppose Chelsea Palin comes through this portrayed as a shining example of a courageous youth, doing the right thing at any personal cost because she knows she can rely on her family. What's more American than that?
Of course, it's Bristol Palin, not Chelsea Palin. That was an interesting slip. You can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Great responses this morning.
Or you can drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll-free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International, in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everybody. Millions of families in America face the issue of teenage pregnancy. Now, John McCain's running mate, Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, is also facing the issue of teenage pregnancy in her own family. Should candidates be judged on the actions of their children?
Yeah, I'm Kyle from Kankakee, Illinois, and referenced the whole Palin deal. I just had to say that what happened with her daughter really has no bearing on anything, and like Obama was saying, his mom had him when she was only 18, so I think it's nice that both the candidates are kind of leaving it out, and I think the media should do the same. Thanks.
We've been getting lots of responses online. You can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
In Thailand today, John, the Prime Minister has declared a state of emergency, calling it the softest means available for restoring order after overnight clashes between government opponents and supporters left one person dead and 43 others injured. Now, this has been weeks and days of clashes. Under the sweeping powers that the Prime Minister has called for, it would give the military the right to restore order, and authorities can suspend certain civil liberties, like banning all public gatherings, and also curbing what the media can be reporting. Jill McGivering is following this story from London for our partner, the BBC. Jill, thanks for being with us.
Welcome.
So what does this state of emergency mean exactly? Aren't the protesters, haven't they taken over the Prime Minister's office?
That's right, and they still are in control of those government buildings. And despite quite a lot of attempts by the Prime Minister to go through judicial processes, they've had a court order against them, they've had arrest warrants issued against them, the protesters are just ignoring those. And as you were saying, since that has escalated into clashes overnight between groups of protesters against the government and other groups who are supporting the government, they met head on and there was no real law and order control around their meeting. One person died, many people injured. I think there's a sense this crisis is reaching a new level. The question is the state of emergency going to make any difference? Because the obvious powers it gives is an extension to the military to allow them to go in and do much more. But we've already heard from the army chief, who has basically said, we are not going to use force to try and get these people out of the government buildings. The soldiers who may be on the streets as a show of force are not going to be armed. So they are clearly, to an extent, sitting on the sidelines and leaving the Prime Minister looking rather isolated.
That is absolutely extraordinary, really, isn't it, that you have the Prime Minister who has called for a state of emergency. Essentially, the army is now ignoring him along with those protesters who are demanding his resignation.
Well, yes. I mean, you could say, look at it from the Prime Minister's point of view and say, well, he is a democratically elected leader. He has control of, you know, he has great support in Parliament, control of the newly elected and newly formed government. And yet he is not managing to get proper control of the situation in the city, which seems to be spiralling out of control. We saw the police being really very ineffective in the last week, allowing the situation to deteriorate. They would be around, but often kind of standing back and letting things happen. And similarly with the military, if they are still saying, well, it's not for us to go in and try and clear these buildings, whose job is it? How is the Prime Minister going to restore order? Some people are saying it looks as though he may have to comply with the protesters' demands and stand down, but clearly that's something he's very reluctant to do.
Well, Jill, I'm wondering if the army here is basically waiting for the opportunity to basically take power, if this is some kind of coup that's sort of going on tacitly, and that the army is really just waiting for the opportunity to say, okay, this is enough, we're going to take back power from civilian control.
Well, we've certainly seen that happen quite often in Thai history, and of course quite recently a couple of years ago when Mr. Thaksin was forced from office. So that's always, I think, something in the back of people's minds. What are the army's ambitions and where do their loyalties lie? Certainly so far, the words we've heard from people at senior army levels, including the army chief, have been saying, look, a coup isn't in anyone's interests. We don't want to do that. It's not appropriate for us to do that. And I think generally that is seen as quite an unpopular move. People in Thailand are quite proud that they've become a modern democracy, and I think they prefer to see politicians in charge, mm-hmm. even when the situation is a bit chaotic, than to feel that the military has to keep stepping in. However, having said that, it is interesting to see that the military seems to be having this rather neutral, hands-off approach, and that does raise questions about what they expect is going to happen. And also, I think, points to some of the very senior levels of support that some of these anti-government protesters have. These are people who are very well connected and part of the Bangkok elite, and I believe are also supported by some former members of the army who still have good connections, possibly by elements of the army as well.
Jill, what's been the reaction regionally?
I think a lot of people are extremely concerned about what they see happening in Thailand, not least because it's, in a sense, a little bit ironic. When you look at some of Thailand's neighbours, Thailand has always been seen as a country that gave a positive example of having made a good transition from being essentially quite a military government at times into a more starting to mature civilian democracy. And yet here we see the democracy back into chaos. So I think concern from the neighbours, but also a sense that there tends to be in East Asia of, unless we really call to do something, we try and mind our own business. None of those East Asian countries like to be too vocal in criticising what's happening in their neighbours' countries, and they're very against what they call interfering in each other's internal affairs.
That was Jill McGovern. Thank you. Jill is a BBC World Affairs correspondent. And now we turn to Femi Oke, who's got the latest headlines for us. Femi?
Thanks very much, Adora. Just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Hurricane Gustav has left more than a million people without power this morning and did an estimated $8 billion in damage. Gustav is weakening and headed through North Texas. Two tropical storms are following Gustav. Hanna is bringing heavy rain to Turks and Caicos, East Cuba and Southeast Bahamas. And earlier this morning, we spoke to Tricia Wallace. She's a meteorologist at the National Hurricane Center. And Tricia says that Hanna is already affecting the U.S.
We've got increased winds and rip currents. We've got a lot of rip tides all the way up to the central portion of the east coast of Florida. And we also have rip currents on the west coast of Florida, remnants of Gustav.
And approaching the Western Caribbean, the tropical storm Ike and another system is brewing out there in the Atlantic. And Hanna may well be in the US by the end of this week. I really enjoyed listening to Tricia talk to us this morning. She was very matter-of-fact when we were saying, well, we've just had Gustav and we've got Ike and we've got Hanna. Oh, no, don't worry. We're just right in the peak of Atlantic hurricane
season.
Hanna's
been downgraded to a tropical storm.
Yes, but once it gets over the warm water again, anything can happen. Can
she
go
certainly
up and down.
Helped put it into perspective.
She did. She wasn't going to let us make it overdramatic.
Yeah, and you're a meteorology fanatic, Femi, so we need someone to balance you out.
Oh, you do?
We do, yeah.
Okay, all right.
That's
all
right. You like the thunder and the lightning, yeah. And we need, you know, someone from the National Hurricane Center.
And right now we need some more headlines from Femi. Right.
What else is going on in the world?
Oh, don't you spoil a sport. Femi, I got off lightly.
Continues.
Chrome is here. That's Google's new web browser. It's available for download on Microsoft operating systems today in more than 100 countries. And the browser is designed to handle complex content like video better than rival Microsoft's Internet Explorer. And Google is still working on a version of Chrome that's compatible with Macs and Linux operating systems.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the role of fertility treatments in helping women have multiple births to accommodate their careers and lifestyles. Is it responsible? Is it ethical? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. You've got world records, you've got tiebreakers, you've got dramatic comebacks, losing streaks, incredible personalities. Well, that's the world of sports. And listening to Muhammad Ali talking at the top of the hour, there's also politics in sports. So as the baseball season comes to an end, a sad end if you're a Yankees fan, we're talking with Dave Zirin, sports columnist for The Nation, author of a new book, A People's History of Sports in the United States, 250 Years of Politics, Protest, People, and Play. David, as we speak, the world's women's chess championship in Russia is taking place, and the Georgians have boycotted it because of the invasion. The idea that sports and politics don't have anything to do with each other, as we hear over and over again during the Olympics, that's just absurd, and your book puts that to rest.
Yeah, I mean, my book is meant to put a stake through the heart of this idea that's oft repeated, that sports and politics have nothing to do with each other. And during the Olympics, it just got ridiculous. I mean, you had Jacques Roche, the head of the International Olympic Committee, saying sports and politics do not even belong in the same sentence. And you had Mike Krzyzewski, the coach of USA basketball, saying athletes have no obligation to be political. Meanwhile, they're all in Beijing for the Olympics, the most politicized and political Olympics probably since 1936 when they were in Hitler's Germany. So, I mean, I think these people are either allergic to irony. I mean, I'm not quite sure. It reminded me when John McCain said after the Russian invasion of Georgia, nations don't invade other nations in the 21st century. And it's like, does he have a comedy writer or are they serious?
Well, that's quite another question, and we may actually discover that at the St. Paul Convention, as far as the Republicans are concerned. But, you know, talking about sports, and, you know, let's get some examples from your book, first of all. You know, there's a great example of sports and politics from my lifetime, and I suspect maybe yours, when Cassius Clay, who became Muhammad Ali, decided that as heavyweight champion of the world, he was going to use his bully pulpit as a way of criticizing the war in Vietnam.
Every time that I enter the ring, in a way, I'm going to war. They say to me daily, you are a prize fighter. What's the difference? And I like to say to those critics of the press and to the others that there is one hell of a lot of difference in fighting in the ring and going to war in Vietnam. My intention is to box to win a clean fight. But in war, the intention is to kill, 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 and continue killing innocent people.
Sports as a platform to project a political outlook. Certainly Muhammad Ali isn't the only one to have done that.
No, not at all. And I think if you had a Mount Rushmore of political athletes, certainly you would have Muhammad Ali on it. People like Billie Jean King, the former football player Jim Brown, perhaps Tommy Smith and John Carlos from the 68 Olympics, Jackie Robinson.
Raised their yes. Hands in a fist, right?
Exactly, and we're about to hit the 40th anniversary of that seminal moment.
Let me interrupt you right there, Dave, because one thing, and I'm not even going to pretend to be biased, I think your book is brilliant,
but one thing
that you did that was really interesting was you took a look at the very beginning, the very founding of this country and what sports meant in the American Native American community, what it meant during slavery for the slaves and the relationship, the intersection of politics and the law and sports. And it has been such a critical component of the fabric of our society from the absolute beginning of
Yeah, it's a fascinating, if you look at U.S. history in three parts related to sports, it's actually a way of understanding U.S. history in a way that's really interesting. Because until the Civil War, sports in this country were seen as something sinful, as something illegal, as something that should be shunned. I mean, people thundered from the pulpits that sports had no place in American life. And then after the Civil War, after the consolidation of the country, you see a whole different attitude towards sports, that sports could be used to build up the American spirit.
Or to tear it down. If you ask W.E. Du Bois, you quote him in the book as saying that sports were bad for slaves because it gave them a sense of happiness when they were not in a happy place.
Right, right.
Although that, you know, that's a really interesting issue you bring up because there's also another scene in the book about when the Americans interned the Japanese during World War II. And the reminiscences of the baseball they played in those camps being a way of, like, getting them through this horrible experience of being interned. Describe that experience and how you found out about it.
Well, the first way I found out about it, interestingly enough, was there's a football player for the New Orleans Saints named Scott Fujita. And his father was actually born in the Gila River internment camp in Arizona. And he speaks about like how he opposes the war on terror and whatnot because of what happened to his father and his grandfather. And I spoke with Scott Fujita about it, and that what got me interested in the sporting culture of the camps themselves, of the internment camps. And it was fascinating how baseball was used as a way just to keep a semblance of community alive during those difficult and dark moments, which is actually very similar to the counter-argument about slavery in this country in sports, which I talk about in the book. Because on the slave plantation, oftentimes sports was also used as a way, as a cover, for example, to retain African customs, mm-hmm. or as a way to actually breed a sense of community in a very difficult circumstance. For example, when they would play dodgeball on slave plantations, people wouldn't be out because they didn't want games where people would actually have to be torn away from each other.
Wow. Well, this book is great, and it really sort of sets the broad canvas of politics behind all of sports. But I want to talk a little bit about the baseball season coming to an end now.
Oh,
Tampa
sure.
Bay, wow. Mm-hmm. The Chicago Cubs, wow. And the Yankees aren't going to make the playoffs. Aw.
I'll say wow to that as someone who grew up in New York City as a Mets fan.
The Mets are going to make the playoffs, it looks like.
Yeah, I know, and it's fantastic. I mean, this baseball season has been, I think, one of the great untold sports stories of this year. I mean, we've been so covered up with it from the Olympics to the Brett Favre drama that we haven't looked closely at this season. And the Tampa Bay Devil Rays making the playoffs, and I think threatening to go deep into the playoffs, I think is the most significant underdog baseball story since 1969 in the New York Mets.
Threatening to go deep, and he always does. Dave Zirin, sports writer, columnist for The Nation, author of the new book, A People's History of Sports in the United States, 250 Years of Politics, Protest, People, and Play. Play ball, Femi, okay?
Thank you very much, John Hockenberry. Coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. The lawyer who conducted a background review on Alaska Governor Sarah Palin says that Palin was honest about her 17-year-old daughter's out-of-wedlock pregnancy. Republican John McCain announced Palin as his VP pick on Friday. Hurricane Gustav slammed into the Gulf Coast with strong winds and rain, but did less damage than feared. 8 people were killed and more than 1 million lost power. With Gustav weakening to a tropical depression, the Republican Party can get back to business at its national convention in St. Paul. News reports say that President George Bush may drop in via video link tonight. The Secretary General of Japan's governing Liberal Democratic Party, Taro Aso, says that he will run for the Prime Minister's job following the surprise resignation of Yasuo Fukuda. Aso, who's a former foreign minister, has been widely seen as a possible successor for the top job since he was promoted a month ago in a cabinet reshuffle. And 2 years ago, the former French President Jacques Chirac walked out of a European summit meeting when a French colleague dared to speak English. The French are very well known for their love and promotion of the French language. So it's a very controversial suggestion that comes today from the French education minister. The minister says the secret to success is speaking better English. He's offering high school students seminars in English language skills during their school vacation.
Actually, the secret to success is speaking better Chinese.
Or Cantonese or Mandarin.
Yeah, indeed.
Yes.
Indeed, yes. Actually, that's for the 21st century. Thank you, Femi.
You're very true.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
Good morning, I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry, and with Gustav in New Orleans on the same week as the Republican National Convention, hey, weather changes geography, it moves mountains, it carves rivers, it stands to reason that weather would change human history from time to time. Laura Lee is the author of Blame It on the Rain, How the Weather Has Changed History. She joins us from her home in Michigan. Laura, thanks for being with us.
Well, thank you.
So, Napoleon lost at Waterloo because of a rainstorm, right?
The weather usually doesn't control the outcome of the battle entirely, but what it does is it tips it from one side to the other. So the water at Waterloo was a big factor in Napoleon's defeat.
So Kublai Khan didn't lose to the hordes of Central Asia. It was monsoons that did him in, right, in the 13th century.
Monsoons and, in the age of sailing ships, the wind would favor one side or the other, and rain can make a battlefield mucky and favor one side or the other. So it's always played a part in our history.
Well, let's look at politics. Mayor Blandick in Chicago in the 1980s lost his primary because he couldn't get the snow plows moving. Snow often figures into elections because November is such a wintry year in the Midwest, wintry time of year in the Midwest.
It does, and bad weather, you know, in a close election can really affect the outcome. I mean, when it comes to national elections, of course, the whole country isn't going to be under one weather system. But what can happen is that the weather can favor one area or another, and you might have bad weather over big rural areas and sparing the cities, or bad weather over cities sparing the rural areas, and that might favor one candidate over another.
Are there examples of where weather or some storm or a disaster actually came in and transformed the reputation of a political leader or a politician because they stood up to the crisis and all of a sudden everybody forgot about what made people hate them before?
Well, most of the examples that I've come across are the opposite, where someone didn't respond very well to a weather disaster. And, I mean, as we've seen with Katrina and the result of that, you know, it didn't bode well for the administration.
So it's always negative. So it's actually true what they say. Everyone talks about the weather, but nobody is good at doing anything about it.
Because the weather, you know, it's a little bit bigger than us. It's beyond our control. So you can plan and you can, you know, do all the planning you want, but it's going to rain down the way it wants to. So
August 30th, 1800, in Richmond, Virginia, thousands of slaves following a man named Gabriel. Complete the story there before we go.
Well, that's one of my favorite stories from the book because it's actually a story of something that didn't happen. Gabriel had planned a revolt. He was very popular, and he had put together a team of many, many slaves, and they had a big secret plan. They were going to meet, and they were going to march on Richmond and take over.
A rainstorm delayed. The conspiracy got out, and the plot was thwarted in the end.
Yeah, they had a huge rainstorm, and they couldn't meet, and that gave the slave owners enough time to find out about the plan and to put a stop to it.
Weather changing history. All throughout the book, Blame It on the Rain, the author Laura Lee. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thanks a lot.
Think about it. In St. Paul, the Republicans have a lot to think about.
Yep.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 2nd, and we have some headlines for you from Femi Okeh. Femi?
Hello there, Adora. Coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. The Big Easy is breathing a sigh of relief today. Hurricane Gustave cut power to more than a million people and caused 8 deaths. The levees that were improved after Hurricane Katrina in 2005 held through the storm. Barack Obama wants reporters to back off Bristol Palin. The Democratic candidate responded to reporters who asked him to comment on the pregnancy of the 17-year-old daughter of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin. Palin announced yesterday that her eldest child is 7 months pregnant and intends to keep the baby and marry the father. And Obama said that family matters should be kept private. In another blow to Thailand's embattled Prime Minister Samak Suntarawai, the country's election commission says that his party should be disbanded for buying votes in an election last December. The capital, Bangkok, is under a state of emergency after overnight clashes between pro- and anti-government groups. Serena and Venus Williams are back in a big way. The sisters both advanced in yesterday's US Open round and they now face off in a quarter-final match. And 500,000 people have flocked to a YouTube to check out a video about high-energy particle physics. Kate McAlpine is a Michigan State University graduate and science writer, and she wrote a rap song about the Large Hadron Collider. Have a quick listen to it.
27 kilometers tunnel underground.
And the Large Hadron Collider is a particle accelerator built in a 17-mile circular tunnel in Geneva, Switzerland. It starts up next week. If you want to find out more, go to YouTube, type in Kate McAlpine, and the rap will tell you everything you need to know.
It's a great story. Thank you, Femi.
That's very cool. The Big Bang and rap. Love that.
Sarah Palin is all over our website. I agree with Senator Obama, Basia says. The families of politicians should be off limits. However, decision makers' lives do warrant some scrutiny. That said, I believe the first consideration should be cultural. You can weigh in at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Or drop a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. Hurricane Gustav yesterday did sort of interrupt the beginning of the Republican convention, and although it did get underway officially yesterday, it was in a very low-profile way, I should say, in deference to the storm. But that certainly didn't stop the protesters.
This is a rich man's war. Mm-mm. What is a poor man fighting for?
Roughly 10,000 people marched to protest the war in Iraq. The march started off peacefully, apparently, but by the end, several hundred people had gotten pretty rowdy and around 250 people were arrested. WNYC radio reporter Bob Henley was there, as was Chicago Public Radio reporter Ben Calhoun. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Bob, what happened exactly?
There were really two protests from what I saw. There was a majestic view of 10,000 people, children. It was a very festive atmosphere with an irreverent brass band and all kinds of puppets that must have taken months to prepare, streaming down from the state capitol lawn and just, you know, block after block of well-behaved police and protesters. Then, of course, there was a kind of rogue element, if you will, that was, from my vantage point, we're using the opportunity of the congregation of all these people to be more confrontational with the kind of approach that the police response should be responded to with what, quote-unquote, more direct action, which included, according to the police and eyewitnesses, vandalism, fire being started at a dumpster, in some cases delegates being roughed up. So there were two very different approaches here. There was a kind of sense of like an intifada vibe by this handful of people, and then the great Gandhi tradition all at the same time. Actually, I knew I had gone through the looking glass when, as I turned the corner in front of the charming Minnesota Children's Museum, I saw a phalanx of officers kneel and change into gas masks. That's when I knew we were in a different situation.
Were there actual clashes between the protesters and police officers that you observed?
What I noticed was the cat and mouse game where the protesters that were with the black bandanas and trying to hide their identity in the Intifada tradition were basically coming in and out of the crowd and then running down to corners where they would have clashes with police. And so, and much of this also in terms of the timeline was not just in the period of time of the demonstration. Actually, the big arrest numbers happened well after the large en masse protest of peaceful demonstrators had disbanded. This stuff continued through the night.
Now, did the St. Paul police call in reinforcements? Were there also National Guards men and women there?
Actually, as part of the response of 30 police agencies, the National Guard had already been integrated into the response because, of course, these local police departments in this rural kind of small-town setting did not have the numbers. So there was already on the scene well-integrated individuals. One of the things that you have here is there's a whole wide array of accounts about pepper spray being used. That's been noticed in the paper. The bottom line here is that the void of Gustav and the impact on the Republican convention not having an image on the front page of the paper has been displaced by things like officers on the ground on the knee as protesters look menacing. The bottom line is that they have kind of hijacked the Republican convention in terms of the public image. As I say in one headline here today, peace and pandemonium.
And Ben, you were actually speaking with some of these protesters, and Bob really describes two different groups. How did you see things?
Well, I couldn't agree with Bob more, actually. And what was amazing to me, and I know this has been the case at past conventions, is for the most part, that other than sort of people bashing up things, people were kept so much separate during the entire march route. You know, the closest point they got was these 12-foot metal barricades about two blocks away from the Excel Center. And so what I wanted to do yesterday, and I spent a lot of time talking to people about whether or not they were going to interact with other people, whether they felt like they were being heard. And the woman we actually heard singing in the intro there was a woman named Patricia Bozeman from Buffalo. And I made it a point of seeking her out and asking her whether or not she felt like she was going to be interacting and be heard.
Even though my son has never been, has to go to war, never went to war, everybody's son is my son. Everybody's daughter is my daughter. I feel their pain. I feel their hurt.
If you wrote that song in 2004, you've been against this war for a long time.
Ever since it came out. Ever since they started this war, I've been against it.
Do you feel like your voice and the voices of all the people that are here today are being heard?
Well, you know, I don't know, but the only thing is not going to stop me from saying what I have to say and expressing my opinion. It's not going to stop me, whether they listen or not.
So, Ben, that would be among the peaceful protesters yesterday.
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
And there's another side to this.
That was the majority. That was the majority of the protesters. As Bob was saying, you know, there were over 100 groups involved in organizing this. There was one umbrella group. But for the most part, you know, I mean, people knocking over barricades and knocking over benches or breaking windows makes powerful video clips. But for the most part, it would have been very easy to watch from any vantage point in that march yesterday and not see those activities.
Well said.
And how did the two interact, those groups who were there to peacefully march and those who seemed to be there, as Bob suggested, just to wreak, you know, some mayhem?
Yeah, you know, for the most part, the protesters, you know, they were just kept so separate. It was so managed. There was one point where they kind of looped down and through, and this was the only point where anti-war protesters and the protesters actually came into contact. There were people who had signs that say victory over terrorism and let our troops win. And even then, I went over to that group of people to sort of see whether, you know, they had any thoughts about the protesters that day. And I ran into a young man named Paul Seafelt, who was an Iraq war veteran, who grabbed me on the shoulder and said, "I'm an Iraq war veteran," and he had something to say. So I asked him, you know, sort of what he made about the challenging of ideas that was happening yesterday, and this is what he said.
I am an Iraq war veteran, and I think the government needs to stay out of it, and they need to let the generals do what they need to do in Iraq. And we've done good things there. We've built schools there, playgrounds, tons of things for these kids there that love us. Everybody comes up to us and thanks us. And I think we can win there.
What do you think about the other vets that are among that group today?
Everybody, we fight for the freedom so they can say what they want.
But what do you think about the fact that you guys disagree? That you share an experience, but you disagree about this?
Everybody has disagreements.
Thank you both. Bob Henley, WNYC reporter, and Ben Calhoun, Chicago Public Radio reporter. They're both in St. Paul covering the Republican convention for The Takeaway. John?
Lots of voices at the convention. A huge story this morning on the news. Oil has plunged more than $7 a barrel. It's $108 a barrel. That is a huge drop. Buy stock today. Lots of ways to catch up with us on The Takeaway. We've heard some responses from quite a few of you about the news that Sarah Palin's teenage daughter is pregnant.
I'm Jennifer, calling from Port Washington, Long Island, New York. Regarding Sarah Palin's daughter, leave her alone. I'm a registered Democrat. I probably won't be voting for them, but leave this out of it. My God, do all of you have perfect children?
What do you think about today's news? Should the media be covering this at all? Should candidates be judged on the actions of their children?
And, of course, you can get involved on our website at mytakeatthetakeaway.org. I'm Adora Udoji.
And I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its Campaign for American Workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.
It's special coverage of the Republican National Convention.
This is one doodle that can't be undid, Holmes Gillett.
I'm pregnant.
Did you see that coming?
Yeah, but I was hoping she was expelled or into hard drugs.
Her DWI? Anything but this. This, of course, is Juno.
Like the city in Alaska.
No.
Alaska teen pregnancy DWI Sarah Palin, the governor of Alaska, works in Juneau. Now she's living the movie Juneau. When it's stranger than fiction, it's just The Takeaway.
All across America, this is The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 2nd, and John, I'd laugh at your opening, except for I don't want to get any more mean emails.
No, we're going to get lots of them. Good morning, Adora.
Today, the aftermath of Hurricane Gustav, which is now a tropical depression. The Republican convention gets underway today in full form, we expect, though no official announcement has been made. Much of the attention, though, will be on details emerging about vice presidential nominee Sarah Palin's governorship and her family life. It's back to school for some college students. Books are so expensive, they're taking fewer classes. Those stories and more, but first, these headlines.
Hurricane Gustav slammed into the U.S. yesterday morning, but with less force than many feared. Gustav's weakened now and headed across North Texas. Watchers shouldn't just relax as a tropical storm Hannah lashing the Bahamas today, and it could hit Georgia and South Carolina's coast later this week. The one good news out of Gustav is that oil prices are down more than $7 a barrel. New Orleans residents are breathing a sigh of relief now that Gustav is gone. Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, says Gustav was no Katrina, but he's warning that residents can't come home quite yet.
We're in pretty decent shape, but right now we have power outages. We're still repairing. We need to repair our sewer system. The hospitals are still not ready.
People may be able to head home by late tomorrow.
Gustav did overshadow the beginning of the Republican National Convention in St. Paul yesterday, but it wasn't just the weather people were talking about. Sarah Palin, John McCain's VP pick, announced that her 17-year-old unwed daughter is 5 months pregnant. John McCain says he knew about the pregnancy. Barack Obama says the press should leave the family alone.
I would strongly urge people to back off these kinds of stories. You know, my mother had me when she was 18.
Obama today is at home in Chicago with no public schedule. John McCain has stops in Philadelphia and Cleveland. Protests outside the convention turned ugly yesterday. The St. Paul police chief says his officers have arrested dozens of people. Self-proclaimed anarchists joined thousands of peaceful anti-war protesters.
Lower oil prices mean the stock market is poised to open higher. You can call our spin box line at 877-8-MY-TAKE to tell us what you think about today's news. Is the Palin story something the media should focus on?
This is Fred Robbins from New Jersey. Do you think people would be judging Barack Obama's character if he and Michelle had an unwed teenage mom in their family?
Good question, and you can leave yours at 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake at thetakeaway.org. It is curious, though. Family values have been a part of American politics since at least the 1980s, the Reagan era.
And certainly an enormous theme in the Republican Party and much discussion over the weekend as to why Sarah Palin was chosen.
It's certainly discussion behind the scenes and in front of the scenes in St. Paul. We're going to have more about that this hour on The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. responsibilityproject.com. The Takeaway is supported by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation to enhance public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. Hurricanes move wind and they move water. And there's a line of powerful storms out on the Atlantic right now, headed for the Atlantic coast. Meteorologists say it's normal. We're at the peak of the hurricane season. Gustav passed through Louisiana and is on its way through Texas right now. And it was a real test of the complicated water movements in New Orleans, a city which has much of its landmass below sea level. The complicated hydrology was tested yesterday by Gustav, and joining us to tell how it did is John Schwartz, a New York Times science writer. We're going to talk with him all about the hydrological systems in New Orleans and the levees, which were supposed to have been repaired 3 years after Katrina. John, thanks for joining us.
You bet.
You know, as we mentioned, this is a complicated matter. You've got two river systems, the Atchafalaya and the Mississippi. You've got Lake Pontchartrain. You've got a complicated series of levees of very different kinds of construction. What's changed? What still needs work based on what happened yesterday?
Well, the main thing that has to happen is that the Corps of Engineers needs to complete the levee system that they've been struggling to get done by 2011, and that's the one that's going to provide what's called 100-year protection for the city of New Orleans and some of the surrounding area. 100-year protection means that in any given year you got a 1% chance of having a flood. The kind of flood that will happen, it will on 1% chance any given year, and they call that 100 years. It doesn't last 100 years. It doesn't, you know, mean you'll be protected for 100 years, but it's better protection than New Orleans has ever had.
Now, let's describe what kinds of rebuilding you're talking about here. Is this a matter of making the walls higher, of reinforcing them? There was some discussion yesterday with the Army Corps on this program that they've begun using different materials, erosion-resistant materials, or is it all of the above?
It's all of the above, but the most important thing about giving New Orleans a better hurricane protection system is giving it an actual system. When the Corps, sort of semi-independent research program, did a look at why the New Orleans levees failed in Hurricane Katrina, one of the things they said was, this is a system in name only. It's a patchwork quilt of flood wall here and earthen levee there, and this earthen levee wasn't very well made, and it ties together here, and there's a gap over here.
There are even some privately owned levees that I discovered yesterday.
Right, they're privately owned levees, but and it doesn't all tie together. And you know, a levee is like a chain towing a car. One link goes, the car's going to roll away. And so what the 100-year plan is about, what this 2011 plan is about, is having a system that is tied together, that when you have these systems, you know, these bits of it coming together at these transitions between, say, concrete and dirt, that you reinforce it in some way so that you're not going to get wash away right there. Because each of these links, each of these transition points is a weak spot. And then on top of that, you got to build the levees right. When they built the levee along the Mr. Go Canal in St. Bernard Parish, it was mainly made from dredge soils. They were dredging the Mr. Go Canal. This sort of muddy, silty crud went up and formed, you know, what looked like a levee. But when the waters hit it, and they were very high surge and everything else, but that levee along St. Bernard went away. What the Corps says it's replaced it with is better soil, lots of clay. Clay's good. You know, there's nothing more low-tech than dirt, but dirt's really good if you mix it right.
John, based on what did happen yesterday, obviously it wasn't the worst-case scenario that some had feared, but what have we learned about the readiness of the levee system, particularly to the west of the city, if anything?
Well, what we learned is that the system, this was very much a dodged bullet. It felt sort of touch and go with the way the waters rose in the Inner Harbor Navigation Canal, but the walls held, and the flood walls had water all the way up to the top and flowing over, and those held.
The pictures were very dramatic there, that's for sure. But, you know, sort of on Adora's question, and it was just a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about the 500-year event in Iowa on the Mississippi River Basin. I mean, you keep using this 100-year plan of the Army Corps that's supposed to be finished by 2011. Don't all these calculations need to be rethought? You know, we're not talking really about Gustav here. We're talking about a whole new set of assaults on these hydrological systems.
That's exactly right. The struggle to build a 100-year protection system for New Orleans is going to be historic, amazing, unbelievably expensive, and inadequate.
Wow.
Because 100-year, the Dutch build for much longer, much more durable systems for much greater events. And New Orleans, let's face it, is likely to get hit by much greater events.
Disturbing history and future prediction. John Schwartz, thank you. John's a science writer for our partner, the New York Times. Adora?
And giving the puttering away of former Hurricane Gustav, the Republican National Convention is back on today. We understand Rudy Giuliani is going to give the keynote speech. Meanwhile, John McCain's campaign is defending the vetting of Alaska Governor Sarah Palin before her choice for choosing her as his running mate. A McCain advisor tells ABC's Good Morning America that liberal blogs spreading outrageously, quote, false rumors forced the campaign to reveal yesterday that Palin's 17-year-old daughter is pregnant. Joining us now is Kate Zernicki, who is reporting this story for our partner, The New York Times. And good morning, Kate.
Good morning.
So what have you found?
Well, we had reported earlier that McCain was saying really until mid last week that he had not made up his mind. I mean, I think he told the radio station on Thursday that he hadn't made up his mind, and it now appears that that really was the case, that it wasn't just a bid for secrecy. They, up until very late, he was considering Joe Lieberman and Tom Ridge. At the last minute, it seems that they sent a team to Alaska to vet Sarah Palin. Now, you have to consider that the people who were in the running before, Governor Tim Pawlenty of Minnesota and Mitt Romney of Massachusetts, had been out for months campaigning as surrogates for Mr. McCain. Ms. Palin had done none of that. And now it seems that in Alaska, no one had any questions about her. No one knew that the McCain campaign was looking into her, and they only started to do it really right before the choice was announced.
And so now we have, 4 days away since she has been nominated as his VP pick. Her 17-year-old daughter is now pregnant. You report today in the New York Times that her husband was arrested 22 years ago on drunken driving charges. There's an investigation into the governor's office into whether or not she participated in any influence peddling. I wouldn't exactly call this a perfect picture for the Republican Party at a time of their national convention.
No, it's probably not. On the other hand, the news about the 17-year-old daughter really didn't seem to offend a lot of delegates here. I think a lot of people reacted in the way the McCain campaign was hoping they would react, which is to say, we all have children. You do what you can to support the children you love. And they're really trying to emphasize the fact that she and the child's father plan to marry.
But, Kate, is this an act of support? I mean, is everyone going to interpret it that way? If you knew your daughter was pregnant, 17 years old, and someone came to you and said, hey, you want to be vice president?
Yeah.
Would you maybe think, hey, I don't want to do this. I got some issues in my family.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly the question. Then it becomes more a question of parenting and of judgment on her part. You have to wonder whether the McCain campaign really, really understood that, if indeed they did know this. They are insisting that they knew when they named Ms. Palin that they knew about the 17-year-old's pregnancy. But yesterday they were certainly scrambling in a way that suggested that they did not.
Oh, and that they weren't expecting all the questions and the kind of attention that followed after the announcement.
Just that they didn't. They were so focused on something, whether it was the maverick image that she projects or the appeal to the women's vote, that people would focus on that and not actually ask the secondary questions, which are, well, what has she actually done and what kind of person is she?
On the maverick issue, I love this, that for 2 years in the 1990s, she was a member of the Alaska Independence Party, which wanted to secede.
Yeah, well, I mean, that has to be taken a little bit cautiously. Yes, indeed, she was. You're correct about that. But it was at a time when the party was very popular in Alaska. Indeed, the governor of Alaska was a member of the party, had been elected on that party's platform.
Probably everyone in Alaska is a member of that party, probably.
Well, I mean, I think they experienced a surge of membership in the 2 years that she was a member. And then, like Governor Palin, a lot of people went back to the Republican Party. I think people saw it as maybe a new party, you know, the new Republican Party in Alaska. And then it was very quickly apparent that it was not going to become that.
Well, Kate Zernicki, we're always happy to have you on our show. Thanks
okay.
for being with us.
Thanks. Bye.
Kate reports for the New York Times and
she's
has lots of
best.
Details on the Republican VP pick of Sarah Palin.
She's the best.
And here's what a listener had to say.
This is Jody from Madison, New Jersey. Sarah Palin should stay home and teach her children abstinence. She's not a social conservative. She's a hypocrite.
Lots of opinions. We want to hear yours. 877-8-MY-TAKE or mytake@thetakeaway.org.
You can email us at mytake@thetakeaway.org or call us toll free at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
869-8253.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, a forum for examining the decisions that confront people trying to do the right thing. Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning. It's Tuesday, September 2nd, the day after Labor Day, and a day when many, many tens of thousands of children and young adults across the country are headed back to school. And some estimate that college students should plan on dishing out nearly $1,000 for books. It's so expensive that one California state study says in one student out of six at the University of California cuts back on classes to save on books. In response, some schools are beginning to offer required reading online for little or no cost, and so are some businesses opening up the texts, not only to students, but anyone who wants to learn. Rick Baranek is the founder of Connections, the open source textbook website based out of Rice University. He joins us now. Good morning, Rich.
Hey, good morning.
Would you explain how your site and your company is working?
Sure. Well, basically what Connections is a new alternative to the standard way of both developing and people using textbooks. The first important point is that they're all free. So everything is freely available on the web to look at, to use, not just by students in regular formal classes, but by anyone who's interested in learning. And the second really important point is that the texts are all open in the sense that not only can you look at them, but you can also update them, change them, improve them, or customize them so that your learning experience doesn't have to be off the rack. It can be truly tailored to your personal needs or to the needs of your class.
Richard, everybody understands what Wikipedia is. This sounds a little bit like that, but I'm wondering if you could tell us how this is different from Wikipedia's sort of open source way of sharing information and developing articles.
Yeah, it's actually very similar. The main difference is just that we have a lot more structure around the quality control of the actual textbooks so that they can actually be reviewed by school districts, by community colleges, by universities or professional societies. Other than that, there are a lot of similarities. The other difference is that unlike Wikipedia, which is really an anonymous medium, and the authors' names aren't listed on any of the Wikipedia entries. In Connections, authors actually get their names associated with all the documents. So it's like a new kind of publishing world.
You know, so would you describe this, just to back up a little bit, because the first thing that comes to mind is when you're saying you're putting on textbooks online for free is, are there any licensing problems with this? I mean, publishers make big money on these textbooks, and they're just allowing them to be put online freely?
So this is really a movement that's developing in parallel with what's going on in the for-profit publishing world. Most of our materials, well, actually all of our materials are very carefully cleared through copyright, and the owners of the works have actually decided that they will open source them, if you will, and put them and make them freely available on the internet. And so the works are either brand new textbooks that people haven't yet sold to a publisher, or they're out of print books that the publishers have decided they would be, you know, make a bigger impact if they're available for free, or there's some, you know, combination of the two.
And it certainly sounds trite to say, well, it's a sign of the times, but certainly that is the case. I mean, there's this fascinating study in Texas where the State Board of Education found 1,900 errors in some of their approved textbooks. The format that you're suggesting would allow those corrections to be made in real time and by anyone who catches them.
Exactly. And in fact, it was 109,000 errors in the state's approved textbooks. This is absolutely a problem. It's going to take a decade people estimate, to get Pluto out of our country's science textbooks as a planet. And probably by that time, scientists will have decided a consensus that it is a planet again.
Of course, Pluto has a large constituency if you just go by the polling data. But
yeah.
How is this different, college text versus high school text? In other words, are college students more able to deal with open source stuff versus the more structured environment of a high school?
Good point. I think that initially these are taking off in the higher ed and the community college space, precisely because not only the students themselves, but the teachers are really, they find this attractive, and it's very much like the kind of things they do every day on the internet. But what we are finding is that very large foundations, school districts, states are actually starting to organize entire curricula from grade 1 through 12 that will be based on entirely open and free textbooks. So
well,
I think you're going to see this over the next couple years.
So a new trend that Rich Baranek brought to us here at The Takeaway. Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Rich Baranek is the Victor E. Cameron Professor of Electrical Engineering at Rice University and founder of Connections, the open source textbook website.
It feels like we went to college 30 years ago.
It does, but I think
so
it's really exciting.
That's
because
great.
Now they have opportunity. Students as well as teachers have an opportunity to help evolve those textbooks. Anyhow, we're going to turn to Femi Oke, who's going to evolve our knowledge of the latest headlines this morning.
Thank you very much. It is 28 minutes past the hour, just coming up to 28 minutes past the hour. Hurricane Gustav lashed southern states with wind and rain yesterday, but New Orleans escaped relatively unscathed. More than 2 million people evacuated ahead of the storm. Mayor Ray Nagin says the sewers are damaged, power is still out, and hospitals need more staff before residents can come home. Authorities say people can start to come back late tomorrow. And the fierce weather isn't over yet. Tropical storm Hanna is slamming into the Bahamas and Turks and Caicos Islands today with some very heavy rain. Hanna could get stronger and hit the southeastern part of the U.S. coastline before the weekend. Tropical storm Ike is next in line, and that storm is still way out there in the Atlantic. At the Republican National Convention yesterday, protests turned violent when anarchists joined thousands of largely peaceful anti-war demonstrators outside the venue. The black masked anarchists smashed shop windows, threw bottles and vandalized police cars. St. Paul authorities say that they've arrested more than 250 people. But it was the ruckus inside John McCain's campaign that had people talking yesterday. McCain's VP pick, Sarah Palin, announced that her 17-year-old daughter is 5 months pregnant. The Alaska governor says her daughter will marry the baby's father. The McCain campaign says that they knew about the pregnancy, before picking Palin as McCain's running mate. And the original artwork for the Rolling Stones' famous lips logo has just been sold. You know, remember those big plump lips with the tongue sticking
Who
out?
Who could forget?
Yes. Nice and juicy. Well, London's Victoria and Albert Museum brought the artwork.
Just your own worst enemy. I tell you, my God.
Oh, I cracked myself up. They bought the artwork for $92,000, and the logo first appeared on the 1971 Sticky Fingers album, actually designed around Mick Jagger's own juicy lips. That's the news.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is supported by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org. And by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, examining the role of fertility treatments in helping women have multiple births to accommodate their careers and lifestyles. Is it responsible? Is it ethical? Discussions and more at responsibilityproject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning, everybody. I don't know if you were paying attention, but there wasn't much of a convention yesterday on the first day of the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. Delegates gathered for about an hour. They voted on some motions and then cleared the hall. President Bush canceled because of Hurricane Gustav. A lot of the ceremony was subdued. Really, the only speeches were First Lady Laura Bush and John McCain's wife, who spoke to the conventioners. And then, of course, there was the revelation about Sarah Palin's 17-year-old daughter, Bristol, who was pregnant. And the question then was, had she been sufficiently vetted by the McCain campaign? Well, none of that was on stage at the convention. There wasn't much on stage at the convention. The convention took place yesterday offsite at the various parties and venues as delegates went to react to the news and to observe what was going on down in New Orleans. And takeaway convention correspondent Faith Saley is in St. Paul observing that convention, that sort of offsite convention. And Faith, what was your mission yesterday exactly?
Well, like you said, John, the RNC schedule was drastically reduced yesterday. So I wanted to see if the parties were sort of, yes, commensurately subdued. So I went to check out the parties. I started at one called the Friends of New Orleans Benefit, which had been pre-planned even before anybody heard of Gustav. And this was called the Jambalaya. Excuse me. There was a hyphen after jam. So I wanted to see how much revelry there'd be there. Showed up. There were beads and loud jazz music and po'boys and a lot of dancing. So people seemed in a fairly celebratory mood. Spoke with the chairwoman of that event, Gloria Didis, and she said they made two significant changes. They changed the open bar to a cash bar because she felt like it would be insensitive if people were drinking for free. So the drinks were $4 and all that was donated to help Friends of New Orleans. And then they added this side room where volunteers were packing 1,000 comfort packages for the Louisiana evacuees, which I think is a nice euphemism, isn't it? A comfort package?
Well, I mean, they were people who had to leave their homes because a hurricane was coming to their homes to destroy their homes. So that
yeah,
might
it sounds
have been
like
comfort.
You might call it an emergency package. Yeah,
something,
but
possibly.
They did throw in things like Axe body spray and some whitening toothpaste. I thought maybe in light of yesterday's news they might throw in some condoms, but they didn't. More on that later. Then there was a party called the
Flames. You're in flames now.
There was a party called the Political Chicks.
Get a hose. Put her out immediately.
There was a party called the Political Chicks A Go-Go, and they decided, in light of Hurricane Gustav, to change the name of the party to the Lifetime Networks and Rock the Vote Relief for the Gulf Coast. Looked like party as usual, except they set out a little Red Cross donation tray by the door and offered up pomegranate lip balm.
Well, that was nice. Different emphasis there.
Says emergency. Right. Yeah. So that was a bit of a non-starter. I mean, the parties went on. People acknowledged that, the Gustav wasn't as devastating, thankfully, as they thought, and people were partying. So we decided to turn to the other storm of the day, as you mentioned, Bristol Palin, 17 years old, unmarried, pregnant, and get reaction from the Republicans on this. They were all on the same message. None of our business. This happens all the time, which everyone kept saying that. This happens in every family. It never happened in mine. Family values are being displayed by, the Palin support for their daughter. We talked to dozens of people. Here's two examples. We've got Mary Madeline, the, TV pundit, and Walker Rutherford, an Alabama Republican. Let's listen to what they had to say.
I mean, this is what happens in families, so I think it'll have absolutely zero political consequences unless the Democrats, as they're wont to do, push, push, push.
I don't know. I mean, I hope that it sounds like she's in a good relationship, but, I'm not there. I'm not her friend. I don't know for sure.
It surprised you these guys were on message?
Yeah, I was surprised that I couldn't find one person who was I was surprised I couldn't find one judgmental Republican who thought that maybe the whole event calls into questions the Palin family values, or maybe this sort of reflects on the efficacy of Governor Palin's abstinence only programs, or maybe somebody who thought it's great this child is having a baby, but maybe she could give it up for adoption to a mature couple. So that was my new mission, to find one judgmental GOPer. I thought for sure I might find one when I stumbled upon a drunken delegate. No, an alternate delegate. I thought a drunken alternate delegate might be judgmental and bitter. Here's what he had to say.
I did when I was a premarital juvenile. I thought about it a lot. I was not very successful, and so I've gotten past that.
What was he thinking about a lot?
Premarital juvenile sex.
I see. A drunken guy thinking about premarital juvenile sex at the Republican convention. Another big surprise.
So, John, this felt like Mission Impossible, and I just stumbled out on the streets of the Twin Cities looking for anyone at all, to make a negative judgment about this issue. Well, on the corner of First Avenue in Hennepin, I ran into an evangelical preacher. Here's what he had to say.
I am a Christian, yes.
And would you identify yourself as a conservative Christian?
Yep, I would.
What is your take on her 17-year-old daughter becoming pregnant out of wedlock?
Whatever transpired there and whatever goes on after, I heard that she's going to marry the father of the child. That would be good in my estimation. But it's not wrong because I think it's wrong.
So I found somebody. I don't know if he's a Republican, but he condemned it.
Because God says it's wrong? Is that,
yeah,
is that,
he doesn't
I,
know
I
if
I
it doesn't.
I didn't quite understand. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Well. You know, in your quest to find somebody to trash poor Bristol Palin, there, we did find.
That
somebody.
Was not my quest.
We finally
my
found somebody to condemn
that
her.
I want to be clear. That was not my quest. No. I was not out to condemn Bristol.
No, right. But in any case, it's certainly a conversation piece there at the Republican National Convention. Faith Saley, our takeaway convention correspondent, all week long with us from the Republican National Convention. And now, headlines from Femi Okeh.
Thanks, John. Coming up to 20 minutes to the top of the hour. And it's back to business at the Republican National Convention in St. Paul. But there's been a shakeup in the lineup. Former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani was scheduled to give a keynote address today. But now it seems Giuliani has been replaced with Fred Thompson and Joe Lieberman. They will talk about their friendship with McCain.
I wonder what's going on there. That sounds interesting.
It's a little peculiar, isn't it? Yeah. A little shuffling.
Mm-hmm.
John McCain's
VP. Kate Zernike on that one.
Yeah, right.
Or Faith Saley.
Sure.
She'll find something interesting.
Absolutely.
John McCain's VP pick, Alaska Governor Sarah Palin, has announced that her 17-year-old daughter is 5 months pregnant. The Palin family says that daughter Bristol intends to keep the baby and marry the father. The lawyer who did a background review of Governor Palin says she was honest with the McCain campaign about her daughter's pregnancy. Russia is lashing out at the European Union for threatening to postpone talks on a new economic and political partnership. The EU is angry at Russia's role in the recent war with the Republic of Georgia, and the EU says that unless Russian troops in Georgia pull back, talks on the agreement will be put off. And that's a look at your news.
Thank you, Femi.
You're welcome.
The Takeaway is made possible by Liberty Mutual's Responsibility Project, encouraging discussion about what it means to do the right thing. ResponsibilityProject.com.
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji.
Good morning. I'm Adora Udoji, and this is The Takeaway.
And I'm John Hockenberry.
And the news, as we've been talking about, has just been full of Sarah Palin's daughter, her 17-year-old daughter, the family announced yesterday, is 5 months pregnant. And so we've been asking people, is that relevant? Should a person be judged by what their children do? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE or drop us a note at mytake@thetakeaway.org. And our producer, Jim Colgan, he spoke with some shoppers in St. Paul, or I should say in Minneapolis, next to St. Paul, where the Republican National Convention is taking place, including a 15-year-old girl. And this is her voice first.
I really don't think that she should be forced to marry the father, and that should be her decision and not her mother's.
I'm a Christian woman. I do think it is not okay to have a child unless you are married, but things do happen, and I think it is appropriate for her and her child's father to marry.
She's still way too young to get married, but if this is how she wants to
her family to grow up, you know, with a full family, then I'm all for her decision.
Not a reason to get married. It happens all the time. Just another teenage person making a bad decision.
Voices of shoppers at the Mall of America there in the Twin Cities, where the Republican National Convention is dealing with the revelation that Sarah Palin's daughter, a 17-year-old, is pregnant. Here's some responses we've been getting from you this morning.
Hi, my name is Mary, and I'm calling from Warren, New Jersey. We're Christian conservatives. I'm a stay-home mom. We have three daughters. I was happy to hear about the vice presidential candidate being a woman, but I'm offended at the Republican Party trying to pull the wool over our eyes when this woman can't even take care of her house. Her 17-year-old daughter is pregnant, not married. I thought they're Christian conservatives.
Well, there were certainly lots of opinions, including this one.
This is Charles from New York. The fact that Governor Palin's 17-year-old daughter is pregnant, I don't think says anything about Christian conservatives or anything else for that matter. This is something that could happen in any family to just about anyone.
On our website, Ellen agrees the media should back off. I feel sorry for Bristol, says Ellen. I think that the press should tread lightly here, though it's a somewhat irrelevant issue, only because the McCain-Palin campaign has... It's somewhat relevant because the McCain-Palin campaign has made it so. But some of you said news has made them question Vice President-designate running mate Palin's credibility on several issues.
Hi, my name is Sandra Mitra. I'm calling from Somerset, Massachusetts, and I'm just waiting to see the bumper sticker that says, "Ask Sarah Palin how well abstinence-only education works."
Huh. And then there were the larger issues.
My name is Leslie. I'm in New York. And it isn't just having a daughter who's pregnant. It's the fact that her daughter supposedly had a choice that Palin would deny other women. I don't see how she can say that her daughter had a choice when she supposedly is so anti-abortion. And it isn't just the daughter's pregnancy. It's the fact that she's manifestly unqualified to be a heartbeat away from the president.
Well, lots of responses. 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is a discussion that's going to go on after the show. It's all about Bristol Palin and Sarah Palin and the question of children and the decisions that their parents make.
We'd like to hear from you at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
Today's conversation on The Takeaway is supported by Liberty Mutual Insurance, offering home insurance products to individuals and families who put a premium on doing the right thing. More information at libertymutual.com or 1-800-4-LIBERTY. Responsibility. What's your policy?
You're listening to The Takeaway with John Hockenberry and Adora Udoji from Public Radio International and WNYC in collaboration with the BBC World Service, The New York Times, and WGBH Radio Boston.
Good morning, everyone. It's a Tuesday morning, and it is September 2nd, and Femi Okeh has the latest headlines. Femi.
Thanks, Dora. Just coming up to 12 minutes to the top of the hour. Gustav is now just a tropical depression, but there's still some heavy rainfall in Louisiana and heading into Texas. Louisiana is now assessing damage and starting the cleanup. Philip Allison is a spokesman for the power company Entergy, and as far as the damage goes, Gustav was a major storm.
With more than 700,000 customers without power, it's already the third biggest storm in terms of customer outages in the company's 95-year history. And the only two bigger storms were Katrina and Rita.
Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal says that it may take 2 weeks to restore power. Mayor Ray Nagin is in New Orleans. He's saying that evacuees shouldn't come home just yet. The residents are asked to stay away until damage has been assessed. Tropical Storm Hannah could threaten the southeast coast later this week, and there are two more storms brewing far out in the Atlantic. And the Republican National Convention gets down to business today after cancelling many of yesterday's events. Speaking today will be the former candidate for the Republican presidential nomination, that's Fred Thompson, and Connecticut Senator Joe Lieberman. Republicans will also be dealing with the fallout from the revelation that vice presidential hopeful Sarah Palin's daughter is 5 months pregnant. That's a look at some of the main stories making news this morning.
Thank you. Gustav, related, the stock market is up 2%. Dow Jones Industrial Average in the first 20 minutes of trading up 2%. NASDAQ is up almost 2%. And oil has dropped $8 a barrel almost. You got to figure that life doesn't get any better for Harry Shear like it was yesterday. Big storm barreling down in New Orleans. He's safe out of harm's way there in Southern California, watching the news media talking about his hometown, about New Orleans and Hurricane Gustav bearing down on it. The news media he loves to parody on his wildly popular show, Le Show. Harry Shear, actor, comedian, voices of all the Simpson characters, many of the Simpson characters, star of the Christopher Guest movies like Best in Show. Harry, good morning. How did your neighborhood do there in New Orleans?
Here's what a thrill it was yesterday, John. I was actually able to watch a German news feed but in the middle of the afternoon. The reporter was standing about a half a block from where we live in the quarter, and I could point to my wife and say, "Our street's dry. There's no debris. We're cool." So that was sort of direct information, but. I have to say, it wasn't a really lovely day. Everybody in or from New Orleans shared this dread that the Corps of Engineers, which let us down once before and has been in charge of the repairs for the last 3 years, might well let us down again. And everybody also remembers 3 years ago when there was a breath taken after the hurricane passed and people thought we dodged a bullet, only to find out that the levee system built by the Corps of Engineers over the last four decades had catastrophically failed.
Didn't
so
the mayor actually
really
say
it wasn't possible to relax until late in the evening?
Didn't the mayor actually say? Didn't Mayor Nagin say we dodged a bullet the day after Katrina?
Yeah, well, that was that was back when people cared what Mayor Nagin said, and it was also the way everybody in the city felt.
So, mother of all storms didn't impress you leading up to the storm.
Well, you have to, that was the first time Mayor Nagin came back into the national spotlight since Chocolate City. But in New Orleans, I've been fond of saying recently that the good news is we don't labor under the illusion of leadership. Now the good news is we don't labor under the illusion that the mayor is even clean. There's been a scandal erupting in the last 3 to 4 weeks over a program that was designed to help poor and old people gut and clean their homes after Katrina. It used federal funds to do so, and a TV and newspaper investigation has found that many of the homes that were billed for gutting and cleaning were never gutted and cleaned. Many were demolished instead, and the second leading contractor under that contract was, drumroll please, the mayor's brother-in-law.
Hmm. Well, on Le Show, you are a strident critic of FEMA and the Bush administration in the wake of Katrina and the local politicians there in New Orleans. And, we do take a breath today. You're right to say that the jury is still out on whether the levee system is going to hold for any significant time period during this hurricane season. Yet, it must have been relatively entertaining to watch Geraldo Rivera wandering around with an anemometer in his hand, the wind speed indicator. Come on. You live for that sort of thing.
It's always interesting to watch Geraldo Rivera with anything in his hand. I have to say, though, some of my favorite things were, the fact that both CNN and NBC announced with great fanfare after Katrina they were setting up New Orleans news bureaus to keep, coverage of the Gulf alive. And you could search in vain yesterday for the so-called bureau chiefs of either bureau on the coverage on CNN and NBC. Everybody was flown in from outside. So you had the usual spectacle of people standing 2 miles away from the French Quarter saying, "I am in the French Quarter," or, nobody knows the geography down there. It's hard even for the locals. And my other favorite moment was on MSNBC mid-afternoon when an official from the Army Corps of Engineers actually said that the city is built under sea level, when the latest study from Tulane University, which was widely reported, indicates that more than half of the populated area of New Orleans is at or above sea level. And if the Corps of Engineers doesn't even know the elevation of the city, that's why you can't take a breath.
Well,
Harry, to be fair to CNN, they did have Sean Caleb and Susan Rosen, both who live in New Orleans. But to your bigger point about how much has been covered as to what followed in the aftermath of Hurricane Hurricane Katrina. Was it the way it's been covered, or just the absolute lack of the coverage that disturbed
no,
you?
No, the way it's been covered, most people in this country still believe that Katrina was a natural disaster. The flooding happened because, the big one came. Well, Katrina, when it got to New Orleans, was a weak Category 2 or a strong Category 1, according to the National Hurricane Center. And most people don't realize that the flooding occurred because of a catastrophically bad job done by the Army Corps of Engineers in building that levee and flood wall system.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's not my conclusion. That's a conclusion of three independent engineering studies that were done after Katrina. And finally, after 9 months of denying it, 9 months we could have used in having them rebuild the system, the Corps came out with its own report in June of 2006 saying, yeah, you're right, guys.
Well, let's shift gears for a second. I mean, the timing of Gustav has certainly transformed the Republican National Convention, and we've just had the Democratic National Convention. Would you mm-hmm. care to do a compare and contrast of the entertainment value of either of these conventions? Obviously, we have much of the Republican convention to go yet.
Well, I thought the main entertainment value of the Democratic convention for me consisted of, would the Clintons ever get off the stage? I mean, they basically hijacked two nights of the convention. People that I was talking to were wondering, you know, wasn't it really logistically possible for Bill and Hillary to speak on the same night? No, really, they had to take two. And then, you know, the spectacular stagecraft of the fourth night, and as good as that speech was, and I think even Pat Buchanan was in the position of saying, that's the most magnificent speech, political speech I've heard in my lifetime, it still was playing defense. And Barack Obama is a good enough basketball player to know you have to take some shots, too. As for the Republican convention, I think, you know, just Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin, Sarah Palin.
She's keeping her baby. She's keeping her baby, Harry.
Yeah, she's keeping her grandkid, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. So Bush speaking by satellite, does that interest you at all?
Yeah, it does for a couple of reasons. you know, the
because you're going to record the feed, right, and use it on your show.
That was quite a chuckle there, Harry, I might add.
Yes, it was. It was
evil.
Mephistophelian.
Yep.
it amazes me that the hurricane and the possible disaster afforded the Republicans and the McCain campaign the easy out of not having President Bush speak at his convention, and yet somehow the fates have contrived to link Bush and McCain on television, something that I would have thought the McCain campaign would have paid dearly to avoid.
Well, we're going to have our cake, and we're going to eat it, too, at the Republican National Convention. Harry Scheer, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, John. Always a pleasure.
Harry Scheer, actor, comedian, host of Le Show, and hometown resident of New Orleans.
And we're always on at the Takeaway. This hour, we're following the path of Gustav and Hurricane Hannah. After that, also checking in on the high price of textbooks and how some are saving by using open source books online.
Should political candidates be judged on the actions of their children? That's a question.
This is Susan from Northern Westchester. I am sure I'm not the only one wondering what the situation would be if a Democratic child had been in the same predicament. The Republicans have a way of taking everything and turning it to their advantage.
But that's definitely not the last word we have heard from many, many of you. And there's a lively conversation continuing on our website, thetakeaway.org. And here's a thought for our today's takeaway.
You know, there's nothing more low-tech than dirt, but dirt's really good if you mix it right.
Got to mix that dirt right.
That's
what
we
do perfectly.
According to John Schwartz from the New York Times, science writer, they're talking about levees.
We mix dirt perfectly on this show, actually.
You
that's
think
what we
that's
do
the
really
case?
Well. We mix dirt. Yeah, we're very low-tech.
Should we be proud of that?
Absolutely.
What do you think our parents would
I'm
think
John
about
Huckenberry.
That?
I'm John Huckenberry.
And I'm a
they love me.
The Takeaway is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, advancing journalistic excellence in the digital age. More information at knightfoundation.org. And by the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org. This is The Takeaway.